Hello and welcome to the Black Spectrum, the place where our black and brown communities talk openly and sometimes anonymously about mental health and parenting issues. I am your host, Diane Laidlaw, and this is episode 2. So first of all, I just want to say a big bloody thank you to all of those people out there that have been supporting the podcast. It's only been out for a week, and oh my God, the love and the emails and the texts and the retweets, I am so appreciative, and it just makes me feel like, yes, this is something that is definitely needed within our society. We really, 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 really need to take the stigma out and make these conversations, like, just normalize them, you know, just have frank and honest conversations about them. So we are officially out on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts. And if you go on the website, The Black Spectrum, which is blkspectrum.com, you will find more information there as well. So it's been a week now since the podcast has gone up. And since then, I've had a number of different conversations with people online. It's been actually quite inspirational and quite emotional as well. It is ADHD Awareness Month. And there's been lots of conversations on Twitter around black women and ADHD. I've been having conversations personally with women who have been diagnosed and some who haven't. And it was through these conversations with these women that I decided to release this episode. Now, this episode is very personal. I'm literally going to be talking to you about my life. But it's important that I have this conversation with you because I'm trying to normalize conversations around mental health, which means that I have to be vulnerable. And a part of me being vulnerable is to talk about what I've been through in order for you guys out there listening to feel that you're not alone and to get an understanding of what could be happening. So I have to kind of go into some depth about some of the experiences that I have. I'm not going to be very graphic, but I will go into depth about the experiences that I had at different stages of my life. So, in order for this podcast or this episode to make sense, I think it's best if I kind of start all the way from the beginning up to present day. So I'm going to give you a little bit of information about my childhood and about my 20s and subsequently my 30s. I got diagnosed when I was 38. And so let's start. I grew up in a single parent household with my younger brother, who happens to be deaf and dyslexic, and he had a whole range of like medical problems. So he was he had asthma very badly and he had eczema very badly, so he constantly was in and out of hospital a lot. My brother didn't get we didn't find out that my brother was deaf until he was 2 years old. So back then they didn't really do hearing tests the way they do them now, where they kind of do them after a couple of months. They didn't really do that back then. So my mum had spent a lot of time basically looking after him on a health capacity. With me, I was a very bright kid. I enjoyed the company of adults more than I enjoyed the company of children. I was quite introverted. From my understanding, my mum would say that other children scared me. But I was very much into reading. So I would read a lot. And she said I was very much into technology. And technology back then was like the house phone or the remote control. We didn't have mobiles or anything like that back then. So, I was a very bright child. Always into books, had a very vivid imagination. But I can also remember my mum saying that I was quite, like, I was daydreamy. I was quite a daydreamy kind of child. I remember being in primary school and sitting down and doing maths, learning the times table. And I think I got up to like times table 7 or something like that. And I just significantly remember saying, I'm never going to be able to get maths. Maths was so hard for me. English was amazing. But maths, I found the most difficult subject to get. And now I have got my ADHD diagnosis, I realise that there's something called dyscalculia, which is something that people with ADHD, some people suffer from. And it's very much like dyslexia, where people who are dyslexic may have issues with words. People who have dyscalculia have issues with numbers, and it's down to really just keeping those numbers in our heads and making sure that we can, you know, do what we need to do with them. We find it quite hard to do. So yeah, maths was a very harsh thing for me to do growing up. I found it very difficult. I remember another memory of watching Grease on a really small black and white TV in my bedroom and watching it from the beginning to the end and realizing to myself that that was the first ever time in my life that I had sat still to watch a movie. I was constantly on the go. I was very I was very tomboyish. I didn't care for clothes much to my mum's she wasn't too happy about that because she was a clothes woman. I just wasn't interested in things like clothes. I just liked to climb stuff and just be with the boys or play football or be climbing trees or be in the mud or something like that. But I wasn't a girly girl at all. When I got into high school, I was still quite bright. I was in the top set for English and science. I was on the second from top set to maths. I don't know how I got there, to be honest. And every single maths lesson was a complete headache for me. I can just remember every report card that I got was, Diane has potential. She's just not living up to it. Diane seems to be distracted all the time. Diane's trying to make everybody in the class laugh. Diane would do so well if only she can concentrate on what she's doing. She could be very consistent one day and the next day she will produce some really poor work. And that would basically be my report card. So there was a lot of frustration on my mum's side because she knew how bright I was. I just wasn't applying myself or pushing myself. And it was exactly the same when we was at home. So at home, my mum would give me a list of chores to do and I would not do them as they were written. I would sometimes miss out some chores or I would do them very sloppily. And that was sloppily, very sloppy. And I was having a conversation with my mum recently and I said to her, do you know that from the age of about 7 or 8, we constantly had the same argument, like up until the time I was 17 and left the house, it was the same arguments. It was, do what I asked you to do in the order that I've asked you to do them, or clean the dishes properly, hoover properly, take notice of what you're doing, or stop touching my stuff. So the stop touching my stuff thing was me always being inquisitive, like I'm always in her room or I'm in the living room looking at books I shouldn't be looking at, going into cupboards I shouldn't be going into. I was just always in things that I shouldn't be in. And I knew that I wasn't supposed to do a lot of these things. This was the problem, I think, for me growing up as a child, is that I knew that I shouldn't go in the room. I knew I shouldn't go in that drawer. But I was so impulsive that I couldn't stop myself going in these drawers. And I remember my mum saying to me one day, why are you doing this? And I remember saying to her, because there's a voice in my head that told me to do it. And she said, well, you need to go and see a psychiatrist. And she, I mean, obviously I didn't go to see a psychiatrist, but it was my best way of trying to say, look, I don't even know why I'm doing this. There's something telling me to do it. And I just do it, you know? And back then, my mum was just constantly frustrated. So typical black household, if you don't hear, you will feel. And trust me, a large majority of my teenage years and my childhood, I was feeling a lot because I just wasn't listening. And my mum ultimately was looking at it like it was a disrespect to her, like I wasn't respecting her and I wasn't listening to her. But the truth of the matter is I just couldn't control my impulses. So if you ever looked at my diary, you would see things like new me, new me, new me, like every couple of months, where I wanted to make a change, but I just couldn't. The consistency of me making changes would not work. I found that when I was in high school, I never really had a bunch of friends who I hanged around with all the time. I kind of like flitted between different groups. So I wasn't super popular, but I also wasn't like a loner either. I had friends, it was just I didn't really feel like I belonged anywhere. Even with friends who I didn't have at school, I still didn't feel like I was normal. And I couldn't understand why my peers, like I had a very good girlfriend of mine who lived with her gran, and she seemed like she was all together. Like her gran would say, you need to do this, 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 and she was able to do those things, whereas I couldn't. And I envied that. I envied the fact that other people seemed to be doing the most basic things and I couldn't do it. So a lot of my girlfriendships I found quite I didn't try to make many, because girls reminded me of what I should be doing and I wasn't doing. So I think that's probably why I gravitated more to boys more than anything, because boys didn't give a toss, you know, they just did what they wanted and then went home. And there was nothing expecting of them. I also remember as a child being very, very anxious, and I'm still a very anxious person. I used to walk with my shoulders up to my ears, and I still do that to this day, where I'm very sensitive of my surroundings. I'm almost hypervigilant of everything. So, and again, that was linked to a few things actually, but I think having ADHD doesn't make it any better. So I was super sensitive. I would take everything that people would say to heart. And if people were laughing or they would make jokes, or sometimes I would think it would be about me. I was very self-conscious of how I looked because I was very tall as well. And I had a very bad accident when I was young, and I knocked out the front tooth. I knocked out my front tooth, so I was very scared of people looking at me in general, but then even more scared because I had this massive, you know, gap in my mouth. So that made me really conscious. I had what I would consider poor hygiene. I didn't like to brush my teeth, I think partly because of the accident as well, but also because I found it extremely boring, and sometimes I would forget to brush my teeth. I didn't like putting on clothes properly, so it took me a while to understand what clothes go with what, and I would never look at the small details of things. So if my clothes needed ironing, I probably wouldn't have taken any notice of that. If my tights had a hole in it, or my jumper was inside out, I may not have noticed it because I was just too busy trying to get it on and not really thinking or concentrating on how it was going on, or taking any pride. So my mum would often chastise me about, you know, me not taking pride in how I look and hygiene and everything else. So I did kind of grow up feeling really, really, really inadequate and just not understanding
why I couldn't do better, even though I knew that I could. By the time I got to 16, I became sexually active and I got pregnant. With ADHD, young pregnancies, teenage pregnancies are extremely high. And because of the impulsive nature that we have, we don't think about contraception, we don't think about any of those things. So we end up doing and getting ourselves in quite dangerous situations. So teen pregnancies is very high with people with ADHD. And at the time of 16, I had found myself pregnant and I aborted the child. And I think after the abortion, I felt almost like I had a FU to the world. I didn't feel good about what I did, but I felt that it was important for me to do because I was too young and I was still in school. I didn't last long in school, to be fair. I didn't end up going to uni. I tried to stay for sixth form. I could only do a GMBQ because I didn't do well in my exams at all. So I had to do a GMBQ before I could do A-level stuff. And I think at that point, I was thinking about being a social worker. I wanted to get into counselling. So I did a health and social care course. And I stayed for like 4 months and then I ended up leaving. I ended up leaving mostly because by the time I was 17, I left my mum's house. And from the time, from 17 up until about 20, from 17 up until about 19, 20, I lived in different hostels and it was a completely brand new world to me. I lived in what I would consider a very town-like area, and then I was kind of pushed into the centre of London, and you know, I'm around children my age who are prostitutes and everything. It was a complete culture shock for me, and I had to now think about fending for myself. So going to school was the last thing that I was thinking about. By the time I was 21, I got myself involved in a relationship that was extremely toxic. It was an abusive relationship. And women with ADHD will have a tendency to get themselves involved in quite toxic relationships and find it very hard to leave. There's a number of reasons behind that. A lot of it has to do with emotional dysregulation, which I'll talk about later. And some of it has to do with your executive function. So, you know, getting yourself involved in a relationship, something toxic happens, and where somebody might hold that memory and be like, okay, I'm going to leave because I don't want that to happen to me again. We find it hard sometimes to hold on to certain memories, not to say that they get lost, but those memories do not convince our current actions. It's like our current actions will override the memory of what that person may do to us. So we end up kind of falling back because we don't have the self-discipline to be like, no, I'm not doing this and whatever. So for about 5 or 6 years, I had spent, I got myself involved in 3 different relationships, all of which were abusive. And it wasn't until I was 27 that I had come out of a another relationship that was very toxic and very abusive. And I went to my doctor and said, look, you know, I think something's going on with me. I think I might be depressed and I need some help. So at the time, the doctor signed me off work. They tried to put me forward for counselling and they just gave me antidepressants. And I took the antidepressants, I think, for about 2 or 3 months. And then I kind of came off them because I didn't really feel that they were doing much for me. And to be fair, I don't even think that I was really depressed. I think that because of all of the different stuff, that had happened to me, I, in my mind, just equated it to, well, there must be something wrong with me. I must not have any self-love. I must not care about myself enough. And it must be depression, because every other disorder that I looked at, and trust me, I couldn't find myself in it. And the only thing I could find myself in was depression. But even though that was the closest one I could find, there was still this part of me that just didn't super resonate with it. But again, like I said, it was the closest one I could find. And I think as well, during from the time I was 19, like I said, I love reading, right? I'm not so much now. I'm more into audiobooks now because I can't concentrate very well when I'm reading. But because I enjoyed reading and I was very inquisitive, I got into self-help really early on. So from maybe the time I was about 19, I was heavily reading into self-help. Also because I changed my religion as well at 19. So I was already kind of reading more and introspecting a lot. I read a lot about philosophy, and not so much psychology, more kind of philosophy. And if I did go into psychology, it was because I was trying to figure out what was wrong with me or what was wrong with other people, because obviously I've been through so many different things, and I'm trying to figure out like what causes a person to do this, that and the other. So when I spoke to my doctor and they gave me the antidepressants, it was after the breakup, like I said, but it was also after a period of me then start to dabble with drugs. And again, the inattentive side of me, people with ADHD are more than likely to be addicts at some point in their life because of the impulsivity, and not being able to say no, or not being able to have any form of self-discipline. So you just kind of get yourself involved in things or involved in situations which you've got no business in, and sometimes it's hard to get out. So this is not to say I was an addict. I wasn't, you know, on the streets taking drugs or anything like that. I was actually a productive drug taker. So I would never take drugs outside of the house. And if I did take drugs, it would be because I was either studying, or I was making music, or I was playing GTA. But I would never kind of do it on a social vibe. It was more, I got things to do and I'm going to do it. So I was smoking weed for a long time, then I stopped smoking that because of anxiety. I got into cocaine, I got into ecstasy, and MDMA. So I think, and speed, yeah. So those were the main ones. It's funny actually, because they're all stimulants, and it was almost like when I took them, I felt better rather than I felt like a truer self rather than a high self, I guess. And it's interesting because since I've been reading up about ADHD and the effects, and realizing things like coffee has been a big part of my life, and I used to feel bad about taking it, but actually coffee's pretty good for people with ADHD because it's a stimulant and it helps them focus a little bit more. The same with cocaine and ecstasy and all of these other drugs that really actually helped me focus, and in some ways gave me a lot of confidence as well. So it was during the breakup and then me kind of going into drugs, and then me thinking, no, this is not where we're going, you're gonna have to go and see a doctor, that I got onto the antidepressants. And then I came off the antidepressants, and during this time, by the way, I was just in and out of jobs until I reached about 25. So from about 25 till 27, or sorry, 24 to about 27, I had a job working for my local council. And the problem with that job was I never took to any of the rules at all. I don't even know why I was still there, to be fair. I think I did a good job at what I was supposed to do, but one of the rules was you wasn't allowed to touch, you know, you wasn't allowed to go onto the internet. And I was constantly on the internet, talking to customers on the phone at the same time, doing like three or four different things at the same time. And my boss would be like, Diane, what are you doing? I would constantly have to have conversations with my boss all the time because I actually couldn't stop myself from going onto the internet. And I remember him saying to me, I don't even know why you come here. Why don't you just get a job in IT or something? Like, why don't you just do something with computers because you're constantly on it? It got so bad, in fact, that my boss made me sit next to him and I was still on the I was still on the internet. Which in some ways I think caused a little bit of rife with some of my teammates because I think they might have thought there was some favoritism going on. But I think that my boss kind of, I'm wondering if he knew that there was something else about me and that maybe is why he didn't let go of me. But it was like the longest job that I had. But when I left that job, I took what he said to heart and I was like, you know what? I need to do what I want to do. I don't want to work for another person anymore because I can't do what other people want me to do. So when I got made redundant, it was literally a blessing in disguise. And this was during 2008 when the crisis happened. It was a massive opportunity for me. So 2008, I got involved more in music and I ended up working on a radio station. And I enjoyed it. It was the first time I actually had a job which incorporated my passions, which was music and people. And I thrived in it. I ended up getting pregnant after about a year, I think, of being there. It opened the doors as well for me to start DJing. I ended up DJing to crowds of like thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And I never saw myself doing that before, you know, but now I was doing things that I enjoyed and I was really good at it. Nobody had to tell me, oh, Diane, do this. I found my space, you know. And then I got pregnant and I was 29 by that time. And I had my son and life slowed down a lot. It slowed down a ton, actually. But career-wise, it bumped up a lot. So socially, I was not going out as much because obviously I had a little one. But career-wise, it went really well. So I had my son and I was getting very bored at home, as you do with ADHD, get bored very easily. And I thought to myself, I need to do something. I didn't want to put my son into nursery. I wanted him to stay at home with me. But I wanted to do something. I wanted to make money. So I ended up teaching myself how to create websites. I mean, the story is a lot more deeper than that, but I'm just trying to keep it quite basic for now. I taught myself how to make websites using YouTube and it went from, it didn't take me long to learn, put it this way. I got really engrossed in it and within a year, I had quite a few customers. And it just started off with a friend saying, could you do a website for me? And then it kind of blew from there. I just kept on getting referred by people all the time. So I was learning on the job, again, kind of putting myself in places that I wasn't really supposed to be, but really thriving in it because I was able to hyper-focus on these things. And hyper-focus is a thing that a lot of people with ADHD have. And just to break it down, hyperfocus, ADHD is the attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, but it's actually not a deficit of attention because we can have amazing attention on anything that we enjoy doing. And what happens is that our brains can actually over focus on things, and we can sit at a table and be hyper focused on a book for hours and hours and hours, and then 9 hours later we realize we haven't gotten up to go to the toilet or we haven't had a drink or whatever, because we are so engrossed. So what you may find with people with ADHD is they are a jack of many trades. As soon as they find something they like, it they pick it up. They literally could just be a natural, and to other people they'll look at you and think, oh my gosh, that person's really gifted, you know, they're really good at most things. But it's because you've hyper focused on it, and it's something that you really, really enjoy. And that's what I found was happening with me in web design, is that I was just hyper focusing on it every single day. But the downside to that was that everything else around me was being neglected. The house was being neglected, bills were not being paid, I was forgetting to cook sometimes for myself. It just didn't, as a parent, I didn't feel like I was super present. I wasn't playing with my son as much, which was bothering me for such a long time. So there were so many things that just wasn't working, and I couldn't, even though I was hyper focused and I loved what I was doing, I just wasn't able to manage the normal of everyday stuff. And that again was causing more issues for me and making me feel even more worse about myself. And now I've got a child, I'm feeling three times as bad now, because it's not just I'm neglecting me, it's almost like I felt like I was neglecting my son. I mean, obviously I wasn't, but it just felt like I wasn't present for him, you know. So there was a lot of guilt around that. I didn't date anyone, so a lot of the time it was just me and my son and my work. So I was able to kind of look at all these different behaviors and think to myself the negative things about everything, really. I wasn't taking credit for the fact that my son was able to read before he was 2 years old. I wasn't taking credit for the fact that my son was like super smart. I was just telling people, no, that's just my son. You know, I have got nothing. I'm just the person who stays in the room. I've got nothing to do with that. So I didn't take any credit for anything that he was doing. When he got into primary school, I ended up putting him into nursery when he got to four. So this was the age where he was able to talk to me properly, because that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to put him in nursery. I didn't want to put him in if he couldn't speak proper sentences, because I wanted to know if anything did happen at the nursery, he can come back to me and tell me. So I was quite adamant that he had to stay at home. But when he did start talking, I thought, okay, let me try and get him to be with other children. And what I noticed was we would jump on the bus and I would go down to the nursery, and he would cry the entire way, and it would bother me, because he's not a crying kind of baby at home. So I didn't know how to act for a long time. I didn't know what to do. And when we got to the destination, he was fine. His first day of nursery was like, all right, bye mum, and then he just walked off. Like, there was no there was nothing, put it that way. I was just like, oh, okay, that's odd. All right, well, see you later, and left. When I came back and I collected him, he was like, thank you, mum, for bringing me to nursery. It was such a great day. But then the next day, I would bring him and he would cry the whole entire journey. And after about 3 weeks of him being in nursery, he was like, okay, I've had enough of that now. I don't want to go there anymore. The kids are crazy. They're screaming and blah, blah, blah. He just didn't like it at all. And with the crying, the journey going back there and the crying, I was just like, let me just keep him at home. And, you know, he's only got a couple months left and he'll be in primary school. So he goes into primary school. And while he's there, the first week of him being there, the teacher was like, oh, your son runs a little bit funny. And I was like, does he? I don't know. My son, he's a very cautious boy. I can possibly count on one hand how many accidents he's had. He has never been a child that will be like, he wasn't like me. He wasn't intrigued with everything. He didn't have his hands everywhere. I didn't have to childproof my home at all. In fact, he just had one particular area where he liked to be, and that was his area, and that was it. He wouldn't experiment going around the house or explore the house, sorry, not experiment. So when he was out and he ran, it was just like, oh, this is just him being cautious, you know. Because he literally looked like he was running, and he was almost mathematically calculating how his feet would run. So it looked very forced and rigid. And the teacher was like, no, I'm not sure about what's going on here. And I remember going back to his dad and saying, this is what the teachers are saying, and I'm not sure how to take it. So they had made a they had basically said to me, why don't you do things with him, like go swimming or play football with him or whatever, and see whether it picks up. So I remember taking him to football, and he would literally, it was like he would follow the rules, but he wouldn't go outside of that. So he could control the ball, but he wouldn't understand really the rules of football per se. And he would almost play, he would have, someone would pass him the ball and he would say, look, mum, look at me, I've got the ball. And he wouldn't continue playing. He would just be like, I've got the ball. And then someone would tackle him, and then he would get really upset and storm off the pitch. And there was only so many times I can actually watch that without getting really upset and annoyed that he just didn't want to play this. So I stopped him from playing football. And then he went into swimming, and he was doing really well at swimming. So I was thinking, well, if he's doing really well at swimming, you know, he can move from one end to the other. He just needs to maybe keep doing that, and, you know, we'll see how it goes. But then he was having other problems, like he wasn't able to put on his clothes properly. He didn't like brushing his teeth. He still doesn't like brushing his teeth. And everything had to be kind of timed, almost like, how long would that take? How long would this be? It was always about, you know, how long things are, or, you know, how much should I read? Even with his writing, it's like, how many words should I write? He just always wanted to be precise on stuff. So the teacher said, you know, we need to send your child to, you know, I think we should see if you can get him tested for anything else that might be going on, i.e. autism. And this wasn't until he reached into year five. So year one, it was all about, oh, his movements. And then by the time he got to year five or year four was when the teacher was like, you know, maybe we should see if we can get him tested. So during the assessment, there was a few assessments we had to take, but one of the first assessments is when they do like a physical test. And at this assessment, the woman had said to me, you know, she had watched my son like running up and down and what have you not. And she said, oh, I think we should get him tested for ADHD as well. I was like, ADHD? Ethan's not really that high. I mean, he's running up and down now, but he's like, in general, he's not really that hyperactive, you know, because in my mind, someone with ADHD is, you know, these young boys running up and down shopping aisles acting crazy, right? And Ethan, he was kind of like that, but it just didn't fit what I thought ADHD was. So I just said to the woman, okay, cool, you know, let's get him tested for everything, basically autism and ADHD, whatever, we'll see what happens. So after that conversation, I went home And I said to Ethan, oh, I'm going to Google what this ADHD thing is and, you know, really look at the symptoms. And when I started reading through the symptoms, that's when it hit me. Like, this is me we're talking about here. And I can't explain the level of relief and aha and really, this is it? This is what I've been battling with this whole time, ADHD. It was like somebody had followed my life and had just pinpointed everything. It was like, do you have trouble with this? Are you constantly losing stuff? Like, losing stuff was my middle name. My mum would give me a key and without guarantee, literally within a few months, I would have to get another one cut. I was constantly losing stuff. Jewelry, forget that. I would have jewelry for like 2 months and then it's gone. Even now, I've never had a credit card or a debit card go past its expiry date. Never. Never. I've always lost it before it got to the expiry date and I've had to get a new one. And then constantly losing something. It's stupid. Even when I go to my mum's house, my mum, just before I leave, she would say to me, Diane, stop, look around and see if you've left anything. Because 9 times out of 10, by the time I've left her house, I would have left everything. And I've had to come back and get it. Where it talked about the inattentiveness and the lack of self-discipline. I can't tell you how many books I've got on willpower and self-discipline and doing this at and a third. And I think, I mean, just to touch on the subjects, it's a bit of a diversion, right? But if you have ADHD, well, for me, I found self-help books to be phenomenal in some cases. In other cases, I found them to be not so much of a self-help, because a lot of these self-help books, depending on what you're reading, and you know, I'm not talking about the self-help books where it's like, you know, how to get a man in 40 days or whatever, I'm not talking about those ones, but more practical ones in terms of like having willpower and determination and doing this and doing that, waking up at this time, and even down to diets, like all of these different things, they require a level of self-discipline, and I just didn't have it. So even with certain self-help books, it was difficult for me because I wasn't able to help myself. I didn't have the consistency to even finish the book, let alone do what the book is asking me to do. So a lot of my own healing has come from philosophy, actually, and changing the way that I view things and stuff like that. But anyway, I'm kind of diverting, but that I really wanted to touch on that topic about the self-help stuff, because self-help doesn't always self-help. It doesn't always help the self. Sometimes it can really put you in a place of guilt. It can put you in a place of self-deprecation. And I think a part of me knew that this whole thing about, you know, self-love and you have to love yourself and everything like that. And I think a part of me was angry with those phrases, because they would say in order to help yourself, you would need to do this, that, and the other. And I just didn't have the consistency to do it, but I knew that I loved myself, you know? So it's that kind of thing. But going back to when I found out that I had ADHD, and I remember going to my friends and talking about it with them, and some of my friends were like, well, I lose things sometimes. And I was like, yeah, but... And someone like, yeah, well, sometimes I lack self-discipline. Sometimes I... And it was this case of people trying to look at themselves and say, well, yeah, but I do that. So... And I ain't got ADHD. So, you know, is this just another... It just felt like they were saying... Like they were trying to minimize what I had been suffering with. And I think because I had been quite successful in my career and other things that I was doing and just picking up and learning and I got really good at it, you know. I think people just assumed that I had it together, but I didn't. I was pretending, I was masking almost that I had it together, but I didn't. So when I'm telling people, this is actually something that's bothering me. It's not like I sometimes forget stuff. Like, it's really an issue for me. I've got debt collectors at my door because I forgot to pay for this, that, and the third. Or, you know, I forgot that I've got to do just too many things. So when people were like, yeah, well, I felt quite disheartened by what they were saying to me. And some people were like, okay, we'll just wait until you get the diagnosis before you say anything to anyone. And again, I kind of felt, I kind of knew that this was what I had. Like, I'd never read something and resonated so hard in my life. So I went back to my doctor, and during this time, I had actually gone back to another doctor, and because I had moved home. So from the first time I went to the doctor, and they offered me antidepressants. I'd been off them for many years now. And something had happened in my life in 2018, which spurred me to go and seek therapy. So I thought to myself, God, man, I'm putting myself in some weird ass situations. Like, something is not right here. I must have some form of depression or something, or some form of PTSD. I need to go and get it sorted. So when I went to my doctor was like, yeah, I'm going to put you in counselling. And it took about 12 months for them to, for it to start. But during that time was when I found out about the ADHD. So we're going into 2019 now. And my understanding was that, yeah, normal counselling would work, but I would also need someone to coach me, because ADHD is... It's not necessarily a behavioural thing, but there are things about my behaviour that I would need to change. And going into self-help or going into therapy is good, but I need to be able to speak to somebody who understands also how my brain works and what I can and can't do, you know? So I went back to my doctor and was like, I need to speak to someone because I think I've got ADHD. And my doctor was like, okay, well, you know, we can put in a referral, but I doubt it if you'll be able to get seen. And no word of a doubt, she put in a referral and it got rejected. So I wasn't able to get seen. But my son, he was in the process. So I was happy for him. But I was also thinking, but I need this diagnosis. I need to just know. I need to speak to a psychiatrist. So I ended up going privately, and I had to save some money in order for me to do that. And just to quickly talk to you about the process of it, basically, they give you documents that you need. They give you three different documents, one which would talk about like your symptoms, you know, little things that you may do, and it's like a questionnaire. And then they would give you another form that will... you have to answer questions about what you was like as a child, because if you've got adult ADHD, you would have had it as a child. So they would have asked you about your childhood, and they asked you about your adulthood. And then they give you another form which you need to give to somebody who knew you from when you was young, whether that's a teacher. Most of the time it would be a teacher, but if not, it would be like a parent, mum, dad, or a caregiver, or whatever. So I gave my mum the form, and, you know, it started to all make sense to her. She was like, oh my gosh, like, really? You know, she had tons of stories for each section. So once all of that had been filled in, I gave it to the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist had already gone through my medical history, seen, you know, that I had an abortion, I had issues of depression, I had drug dependencies and whatever. And all typical traits, I guess, of what ADHD was. And as I sat with him and I had a consultation with him for about, within the first 45 minutes, he basically said to me, Diane, you're not depressed, you've got ADHD. like categorically you've got ADHD, and you know, it's really up to you, like, where do you want to go with this, what help do you want after this? And I think as soon as he had said that to me, the sight of relief that a psychiatrist, and this wasn't just any old psychiatrist, this man was so skilled in ADHD, it was his thing that he would teach. He would actually have classes within the NHS where he would teach other doctors and psychiatrists and whatever. So I was in safe hands here, you know, and actually it was the first time in my 38 years that I actually felt listened to by a doctor. And that was quite sad, because there were other times in my life where I had gone to the doctor. I remember when I was 19 and I said, you know, I think I'm depressed. And the doctor saying, you're too young to be depressed. And I remember going another time and I actually had counselling, but I only had counselling for one session. And the counsellor was like, I can't counsel you anymore. And I've got no idea why he stopped counselling with me. He didn't tell me why. He could have just left the business, I'm not sure. But because I was young and I was emotionally dysregulated, I took it very, very personal. So it took me a very long time to kind of put myself back into a doctor's surgery again and say, look, this is what's happening to me. And the only time I managed to do that was after my last abusive relationship. And at that time, I'd shaved my head and I didn't look very I didn't look very well. So I think my doctor took me more seriously then. So to kind of go privately and have this doctor, you know, really watching me and understanding what I'm saying to him. And I just felt heard for the first time. And we spoke about medication and I just said, yeah, I want to go on medication. So let me talk to you a little bit about medication. Just before I got my diagnosis, I made a post on Facebook about reading a book on ADHD and not being able to concentrate on the book. And a few people reached out to me and was like, why are you reading that book? And I said, because I think I've got ADHD. And one particular person, and funny enough, all the people that come to me and said, why are you reading that book? They all had ADHD as well, but they were quietly living with ADHD. A family member came up to me and said to me that she had ADHD as well. That family member's 60 years old. And she got diagnosed a couple of years ago. She explains to me that what her life was like beforehand and how she got medicated and how her life is like now. So I had a very deep conversation with her about medication, and she really put my mind at ease in terms of how the medication works. It's not like antidepressants where you've got to keep taking them and taking them and taking them, and then you might get an effect after like 3 weeks. ADHD medication, it works instantly. So you take it and within 15 to 60 minutes, you will, it works. And depending on the type of medication you've got, it can last for 4 hours, up to 12 hours. The one that I have is about 12 to 15 hours. So I have to take it very early in the morning. I remember getting my first dose of medication and they started me on the lowest dose. And what they do basically is there's a titration process, which is where they monitor you over like a period of a week. You take the medication for a week and then you write down how you're feeling, side effects, what's worked for you, what hasn't worked for you. They check your blood pressure, your weight and everything like that, which you need to get done yourself, and you just report it back to them. And I think one day I accidentally took two because I forgot that I took one, so my dosage went up to 40 and I was like, oh, this feels like I'm able to kind of get to where I'm going here. Whereas the 20 kind of felt like the key was in the ignition, but it wasn't like proper starting yet. So after a while, I was able to actually find my appropriate dose. And I was able to go back and forth with the psychiatrist to kind of explain to them what I was feeling. And there was a couple of instances where I was taking coffee. I was still drinking coffee while I was taking the medication. And I was noticing that I was getting quite angry. And I had to write that in my report. And when I spoke to the nurse, she was like, yeah, you you don't want to mix a stimulant with another stimulant. No, take that off. So I was a bit scared with that. I was like, why am I getting angry? But yeah, it was literally because I was still drinking coffee. And, I don't know what's wrong with me. So I just want to talk about how it made me feel. So I took the medication and I just remember feeling like I can understand everything. It was weird. I would pick up a book and I was able to read the page of the book without having to go back and forth over a paragraph, because what I tend to do is when I'm reading something, I lose my trail of thought. So I'm reading a book, I'm reading a paragraph, and then my mind wanders somewhere else and I have to come back to that paragraph and read it a few times before I can really digest it, before I can move on. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I will skim something and I don't even know that I'm skimming it. I even got to the point where I tried to speed, like learn how to speed read. That's how bad it was, because it was like, flip it, I'm going to read the book this fast. But the comprehension, I was able to read fast, but the comprehension was actually the main problem. It was the understanding of what I was reading. And I remember taking the medication and picking up a book on JavaScript, which is a coding language, which I had enormous difficulty trying to understand. And picking up a book on JavaScript and actually understanding what it was telling me. And that was like a massive wow moment for me. It was like I was in the dark and then suddenly somebody switched on the light and I was able to see. I was able to be, oh my gosh, I understand. I know what this is about now. Whereas before, it was like a blur. I was able to walk into a shop and know what I was going to buy, pick up that one thing, buy it, and walk out the shop. Now, to some people, they'll be like, okay. But to me, that was a big thing, that I was able to just go in there and I wasn't roaming up and down and impulsively buying stuff. Like, I was like, no, I need hairbands. I'm going to go in the shop, pick up hairbands and walk out. Another thing I noticed I was doing was that if I had a thought to do something, I wouldn't delay it. There wouldn't be so let me give you an instance. I will be in my house and there will be a piece of paper on the floor and I would walk past that piece of paper 10 times. And every time I'm walking past it, I would say to myself, you need to pick it up. You need to pick it up. You need to pick it up. And I wouldn't. And while I'm doing it, I'm making myself feel even more shit every time I walk past it, because I know it's something I need to do. But when I was medicated, that thought of I need to pick it up became an instant action. There was no delay within that process. And if you read more about the neuroscience to do with ADHD, you would super understand why that happens. It's almost like there's a glitch in the matrix between your thought and your behavior. And for me, having to be able to think of something and now, boom, I'm doing it. I'm thinking about washing my dishes and boom, I'm at the sink. Whoa, what? There was no middleman to pollute my thoughts or to stop that action from happening. There was also stuff like I would order takeaways a lot in the house, and I would usually order takeaways because I haven't washed the dishes, and the thought of having to wash dishes would mean extra. It would mean it would be pulling me away from what I was currently doing into doing something I didn't want to do. And that was often very hard for me. And I remember sitting at my desk thinking, oh, I'm quite hungry. Let me go and order a KFC. And then I looked and I was like, I don't need to order a KFC. I just need to wash my dishes. And then I can make my own KFC. And again, these things you might laugh at, but honestly, for me, the queen of takeaway. At one point, I was also the queen of Uber as well, because yeah, it was having that impulsivity taken away was a lifesaver for me. You know, knowing I have to do things and knowing that I can now have the self-discipline to do it was a beautiful introduction into my own life. Another positive about having the medication was I wasn't as emotionally reactive as I was before. I wasn't as sensitive as I was before, which meant that my anxiety dropped. My shoulders wasn't so high up anymore. I would be walking on the street and I'm not thinking about whether people are watching me or any of that. Like, that anxiety just went. It was like I'm moving from one place to another, and I didn't have these extra tabs in my head. I was able to watch a YouTube video, a 10-minute YouTube video, all the way through. Before, if I watched a 10-minute YouTube video, by minute 7 or minute 5, I'm immediately trying to look for other things to do while I'm watching. It's very rare that I'd be able to do one thing at once. I'm always doing multiple things at the same time. My driving got better. I mean, my driving's pretty good anyway, but my driving got better when I was medicated. There was a whole bunch of stuff, and it was a completely different world. The negative side of taking medication was if you took it at the wrong time, you would be up all night. I'm a night person anyway, but when you've got a kid and you've got to take them to school, that's not the one. For me, it wasn't the one anyway. So there was a lot of restless nights, and that obviously affected me the day after as well. Another negative thing about taking the medication was before, I never paid any attention to details. And I saw that as a massive flaw of mine. I can't pay attention to details. I'm a web designer. I should be able to pay attention to details, but I can't. You know, I look at the bigger picture of things. But as soon as I got medicated and I looked back at my websites, I was like, what the f-? I was able to see everything. Everything. And again, it was just like, the light was off and somebody turned it back on again. It was crazy for me. But it also meant, the reason why it's a negative is because with my creative side, in terms of creating anything really, it would take me longer. And I wasn't as creative as I was before. I was more logical rather than creative. So I would create something, but then I'd be immediately into the editing phase and not just letting it be. Like, I didn't know when to stop, when something just felt right. It was like, I would create, let me make it a little bit easier to understand. Like, if you create something, there's usually a point within your own self where you have this feeling like it's done. And because I was medicated, that feeling of it's done took longer. It was almost like I would never get to that feeling. So I would constantly be changing my work, even though it didn't need to be changed. And that bothered me. Also, one of the other negative things about taking the medication is that you lose your appetite. Now, for other people, that is a negative, but for me, that was actually a big positive, because I was in the almost morbidly obese stage. I had been skinny for all my life, and then I had my son, and I put on so much weight. And I guess because I wasn't going out as well, and I was, you know, primarily sitting at the desk all the time, I piled on a lot of weight. And I found comfort in my weight as well, but I just didn't like how my body looked. I didn't, even though I felt comfort in it and it made me feel like I was strong, I just didn't like how my body looked. So when I tried to diet, because I also lack self-discipline, it was hard for me to stick to any diet. You know, do a 24-hour juice fast, mate, I'm lasting like 2 hours. Already my impulsivity is kicking in and I'm talking my way out of it. So when I got onto the medication, I started to lose weight drastically and I was happy for that. So for me, it was like, that's a win situation actually, because I was able to lose so much weight. And also I wasn't comfort eating, which also helped. And because my calorie count had also gone down, it was a bunch of stuff. Like, I was just happy that I had lost the weight. But if I was already skinny and taking it, that probably would have been a problem. So if you are thinking about taking the medication and you are, you know, roughly at your average weight, I would highly recommend that you make sure that you eat before you take it. Make sure you have something light, maybe midday. And then, you know, when it goes into the evening, that's probably when you would get hungry. And the funny thing about that is there is this like a hunger rage that you get into like near the end of the medication, maybe like the next day, because you haven't eaten. Well, for me, I found that because I hadn't eaten the day before, the next day when I would wake up, the hunger was just, I was able to feel it in my body, you know? But that was basically all the negatives, really. And the negatives were manageable. I do not take my medication every day as well. Some people think to yourselves, oh, you have to take it every day. You don't have to take it every day. I have a few friends who are medicated, and some of them, I got a friend, for instance, who she's like, I only take it when I need to get housework done, you know, and because that's her motivation. That's what she needs it for. For me, because I work from home, it helps with my concentration, especially when I'm studying. I managed to get a diploma in one night because I was hyper focusing on a course that I was doing, and I managed to finish it from start to the end in one night, which was crazy. So when I'm doing something creative, I don't take my medication. If I need to edit that, if I need to do editing, then I would take that medication. Another thing as well about the medication is that it does make you quite talkative. And your words come out way more fluid than before, which is quite interesting as well. I love that about it because I don't really like talking on the phone per se, but when I'm catching up with friends, it's quite good to take before I'm catching up with them. It makes me more into the conversation than probably I was before. I'm quite introverted in that way, unless they're really, really close friends and I'm not so introverted. So that really has been my journey into learning about ADHD. My son got diagnosed with ADHD about 6 months after I got diagnosed. And I think having my diagnosis and being able to, I kind of got really deep into reading up about the symptoms, and I started joining many Facebook groups and stuff like that, and talking to other women who were suffering and talking to parents who had ADHD themselves, and finding out that, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one who doesn't like playing with my son. You know, I get really bored and I want to do something else. And it was like, actually, there's a whole bunch of us in this group who are feeling the same way and just felt like we were really bad parents, you know. And just learning different tips about what we can do to be better parents and to look after our children who have also got ADHD, because ADHD is extremely hereditary. I'm very certain that I've got brothers who have got it. I know my sister has it. I'm 101% certain my granddad had it. It does get filtered through the family. So if you was a person that had it, there is a 60 to 70% chance that your children will have it as well. It does skip generations too. Like, I don't think my mum has it, but I'm definitely certain that my granddad definitely does have it. What other stuff can I talk about in regards to ADHD? ADHD is definitely there's a lot of controversy behind it, mainly because the symptoms of ADHD are continuing aspects of everyday behavior, of losing stuff, of emotional dysregulation, very high empathy, being seen as lazy. It's an inconsistency disorder, to be fair. It's more about inconsistency for us. There are times where we have lots of energy, days where we can perform some amazing stuff, and then after a couple of days we have a crash. And I know when I was working for the council, even working for any of the jobs that I was in, I found it difficult to hold them down, not just because I didn't listen to rules, but also because some days I would wake up and I would have absolutely no energy, and I would have to phone my work and lie and be like, I'm sick. And it wasn't, it was just, I just didn't have the energy. Consistency in life, we really, really take it for granted. And other people look at us and think, well, we're just lazy. You know, that's one of the words that we may hear a lot when we're younger, depending on who our caregivers are, or even who our partners are, where it's just, you're lazy, you're forgetful, you don't care, you're dirty, you're messy, you're all over the place, you're ditzy, you have no self-control, you're over emotional, you're too angry, you're hypersensitive, you talk too much, you can never stick to one thing. Why can you never finish anything? Why you're a great starter, but you don't finish anything? And, you know, these were just some of the things that I can remember hearing as a child, especially that you're not finishing everything. And especially the, you can't be a jack of all trades. You have to master one of them at least. And I just knew from my brain, I couldn't. I had interest in everything. Astrology, interior design, criminality, psychology, religion, tech, music. I just had lots and lots of different interests, and it was like a shame for me to not want to explore everything that I was into. And I also found that when I picked things up, I learned really quickly. So I learned really quickly how to sew and how to knit and how to DJ and how to create websites, and people are looking at me like I'm some, like, why is it you got the Medias touch? Why is it that you do something and you pick it up and like you're just in it? And it's like, I couldn't understand it. I was just like, I'm just fast. That's why I used to tell people, I'm just fast. I'm just into everything. So there was a lot of healing that I have to do, and I'm still doing to this day. Because even though you get the diagnosis, even though you get the medication, even though you start to understand your brain more and you can give excuses for your behavior, or you know the reasons why you can do things and you can't do things, there was still a lot of healing that I needed to do in terms of my own self-talk. My self-talk had been so bad over the last 38 years that a lot of philosophy actually helped me rationalize a lot of the situations that I had been through. I do have PTSD, and PTSD, a lot of the symptoms do roll hand in hand with ADHD. ADHD is a comorbid disorder, so you can have things like depression with it, OCD, borderline personality disorder as well is another one that kind of, the symptoms are very, very similar to OCD, ADHD. Again, depression is also quite similar with ADHDs. And I think that's the reason why I was kind of more thinking that that might have been what was wrong with me. But the truth of the matter is I didn't really have a loss of interest with things. I wasn't in bed because I was sad. I was in bed because I was like drained. I just spent like 3 days building a business, you know? So the healing for me, I think, is I'm still working on it. I'm still working on rewriting scripts. I'm still working on trying to be, trying to comfort myself in times when I do get emotional dysregulation, especially with PTSD. It's very difficult to discern which one it is. Like, is this my PTSD or is this my ADHD? It's like a double whammy, really, because if it isn't the PTSD, it is definitely, you know, the ADHD that's causing me to feel oversensitive about things and having to kind of deal with that, especially when I'm in relationships. I find that it comes out the most, and having to work on that, it's making me understand the type of person that I need to be with in order for me to feel comfortable. And it's the same, I think, with most people who have got any kind of a neurodiverse brain, is that relationships of people who are your friends, who are your partners, like your inner circle, need to understand where you're at, you know, because that will help with your healing. No man is an island, and our ideas of who we are as individuals are not based on our ideas of who we are as individuals. They're based on our interpretation of what other people think we are. So if somebody's constantly telling you you're lazy, you're going to include that in the bio of who you are, even though it's not true. So it's important that you're around people who you don't have to mask yourself with. You know, it's important that you're around people who understand what your brain is doing. Can understand, oh, do you know what? He or she's going through a moment right now. They're quite impulsive. Someone who's actually going to be like, do you know what? Let me take care of the bills because you're not doing such a great job. You can't remember stuff, you know? And not trying to fit you into something which you might not necessarily be able to do. You know, someone who doesn't have legs shouldn't be forced to run. They should do what they are comfortable in what their skill set is in. And that's why I love the term of neurodiversity. It's not about I need to be like this, I need to be more like this. It's more of let me look at my strengths and let me work on that, because the negative side of me, there isn't that much I can do to control it. I can try to manage it as best as I can, but I've literally read so many self-help books to do with like self-determination and motivation, and I still can't get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I still can't go for that jog. I still can't get up at 7 and meditate like I want to do. You know, I've had reminders on my phone that I need to do that, and the consistency is what I find it difficult to do. The consistency is hard for me. You know, this isn't to say that I'm never going to do these things. It just means I just need to be more patient with myself, because I know that I'm trying rather than I'm failing, you know? So that is basically it. That is my story in terms of my journey to ADHD and me talking to you about the different traits that I had as a child that I'm sure a large majority of people can relate to. And I think if I was younger and I had the internet, it would have been easier for me because I would have found this, I think, a lot more easier. I wasn't able to really find it when I was young because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have these groups of people that can help guide us or whatever. If I had my diagnosis back in the 80s, there would have been no one that I could have really spoken to because I think it was 1982 or something like that was when the official name of ADHD became known. But it wasn't, 1982 wasn't where, you know, it's not, ADHD is not a new thing. It's been around from the beginning of fucking time. It's just now they've been able to put a name to it and they've been able to call it ADHD, just like they put a name to autism and was able to call it autism, you know, just like in 1930 when they found Pluto. It had been there the whole time, but they had discovered it and called it Pluto. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think I would have been able to find the community that I found now, back in the 80s. So I'm grateful for the internet, and I think this is the reason why this podcast is important for me, because I want people out there to not go through the 20 years of madness that I went through. And I want to shortcut it. I want to get more people to get a quicker diagnosis rather than having to waste their life feeling inadequate. And for children as well, if your child is exhibiting signs, you know, we're scared, and I mentioned this in the first podcast, is that we're so scared of labels that we don't understand the power that labels can have over people, especially with mental health problems, because they know that something is wrong with them. They know. Just like I knew something was wrong with me, just like all the other women who I've been speaking to, especially over the past month, they knew, but they didn't know what it was. And it's that not knowing what it is that means that we end up turning that finger towards us and saying, it's just me. I'm not good enough. I'm inadequate. I'm just not getting it. You know, having the label frees you from having to self-deprecate. And I would exchange self-deprecation for a label any day of the week. I'm sorry. That's just how I feel about it. I feel like with children, because they are so young, they are highly impressionable. Highly impressionable. By the time they're 9 years old, they kind of already know who they are, based on the messages that they've received from their parents, their peers, and from society and everybody else. And I think the longer we hold off from giving them a label is ultimately... And it's ultimately the damage. The damage is longer, you know? And a label doesn't need to define you either. It doesn't need to be like, okay, well, but unless you want it to define you. But it doesn't need to define who you are as a person. It doesn't mean that because you're autistic that, you know, you'll never hold down a job, or because you've got ADHD, you'll never hold down a job. No, it just means that you need to be put in where you fit in. And sometimes where you fit in is not necessarily in the office. Sometimes it's in a radio station. Sometimes it's behind a chalkboard where you're in front of children and teaching them. Sometimes it's riding the bus, because that's what you feel joy in. So you just need to find your thing and excel in that and not feel that you need to fit in with everybody else, because that's where the real damage lies. And that's why I'm kind of adamant about, you know, if you have children and you feel that there's something not 100%, or if your child comes to you and says they don't feel like there's something 100%, please just explore it. And while you're exploring it, educate yourself, because I'm also hearing stories of parents who do get the diagnosis but they don't read up about it, and it's this form of, well, okay, this is what they got, but, you know, having to read up about it, I guess for them, may cement that belief. And sometimes people don't want that belief to be cemented. But I'm telling you, if you have a diagnosis for your child, the least you can do for your relationship with that child is to read up about how it's affecting them. Because that time when you're going to sit and you're going to, why don't you do this? Why am I repeating myself a million times? When we get to that stage, this is when the negative reinforcement of our own wounds, almost our own disappointments, are projected onto them, and they don't deserve it. So that's it, I think, for this podcast. It's been quite long, I know, and I'm probably not going to edit it because it's like an hour and a half, and no. So thank you so much for listening. If you have any questions, please reach out to me on Twitter. I'm super enjoying Twitter right now, especially over the October period, because it was ADHD Awareness Month. So it was beautiful watching the conversations that people are having about knowing that they have this. And, you know, some people are finding it difficult to go through their doctors at the moment because the doctors are, you know, the gateway to getting an assessment done, and a lot of the doctors are blocking it. Out of ignorance, some because certain boroughs, like my borough, don't really treat adult ADHD that important, especially if it's self referred. If it's self-referred, it's like, oh, really? But if you had come through maybe a different route, for instance, if you went into therapy and your therapist was like, I feel like you've got ADHD, then maybe they would see you via that way. But for the self-referral route, it's a little bit difficult. If you go onto the website, the Black Spectrum, the blkspectrum.com, and you scroll to the bottom, if you are a person who wants to get a referral done, and you're finding it difficult at your doctor's, there is actually a link that will enable you to get a referral, like you can request for your referral to be done elsewhere. So it doesn't have to be in your borough. You could actually refer them, get them to refer it elsewhere. So there's a website called Psychiatry UK, which is what I used for my assessment. And they work hand in hand with the NHS. Like, most of the doctors and psychiatrists that work for Psychiatry UK, most of them are from the NHS. So what you could do is you can just go to the website, go to my website, and there should be a link at the bottom where you can actually download a form, and you give it to your doctor and you say, I don't want you to refer me to this. I want you to refer me to Psychiatry UK. And what Psychiatry UK, because they're private, what they would do is they will apply for funding on your behalf, so then you won't have to pay, and they will get the treatment done for you. It may take a little longer. It may take a couple of months to get it done, but at least you're already on it's better to apply for it than just get shut down by your doctor. If you paid for it privately, you literally can get seen within like the week. As long as you've got you can literally get seen within the week. So it was quite quick. For me, it was quite quick to get the diagnosis done. But if you're going to get funding, then it's the funding process that you may have to wait. And apparently the funding, you will get the funding, it just takes a bit longer. So if you're having issues with that, please, like I said, go to my website, theblackspectrum.com, and have a look. Also, if you're a person, if you're worried about whether you've got ADHD or you're not sure, there is also, if you go to my Twitter, there's a pinned post which has all the symptoms of what ADHD is, and you can go through it and see which ones, if they relate to you or not. And if they do, if a large majority of them do relate to you, then, you know, that might be something that you can go to your doctor and speak to them about, if you want to get diagnosed, that is, because some people, they may not want to go through the whole route of getting diagnosed. They just, you know, you could still have ADHD and not be diagnosed. So again, thank you for listening. Sorry for the rambling. And yeah, I will speak to you soon. There's going to be some new interviews that are coming out, and I really, really can't wait to show them to you. So I will see you then.
If you are struggling with your mental health, please visit theblackspectrum.com to view resources and links that may help. Thank you for listening.